Welcome to the APA Podcast, where we help one another follow Jesus at home, in our city, and around the world.
Awesome. Great to be with you today. My name's David, one of the pastors here. It's a pleasure to bring God's Word today. Before I get into it, though, one last quick staff announcement. Pastor Olivia has been with us for a while in various roles, currently serving mostly in our finance department, but helping with lots of different areas. She has accepted a call to go to Bethel Church in Penticton, starting at the end of November. And if you didn't know this, that's my old church. They're getting you back for stealing me by stealing. Anyways, I'm so excited for her. It's a great position. It suits her so well. And so she's not here today. She's off this weekend. But when you see her next, you got a few more weeks with her, please give her a hug, bless her, slip her a 20 or 100 or whatever. Just encourage her, thank her for her ministry here. And we just release her in the name of Jesus and are so thankful for what she's done. We'll do an official goodbye in person on her last Sunday, but keep her in your prayers. Mount Everest. Anyone been there? Me neither. But Mount Everest is 8,849 meters high. That's almost 9 kilometers straight up into the air, or over 29,000 feet. Compare that to the biggest mountain that we can see from Abbotsford, Mount Baker, which is only a third the size. It's 3,288 meters high, or 10,700 feet. So take three Mount Bakers. Imagine how dominant Everest is in the sky. The first time Everest was successfully summited was in 1953 by Edmund Hillary. Many people tried before him and failed. Many of them died in the attempt. Many of them tried and failed since. But there have been a lot of people who have successfully accomplished the feat since then. Better technology, better ability to predict weather, and the experiences of the past have made it, quote unquote, easier or at least less dangerous to attempt. But it still remains one of the most dangerous adventures in the world. And even with all the great technology and weather predictions and everything that climbers now have, it still costs many men and women their lives. The policy for Mount Everest is if someone is lost on the hill or dies or falls down and is unreachable by easy means, they'll actually leave the body there. And so Mount Everest is actually littered with the bodies of those who have attempted to climb and have failed. One of my favorite quotes about this is this: every dead body on Mount Everest was once a highly motivated individual. So maybe chill out a little bit. You know, I'm glad you're excited about something, but hey, keep this in perspective. But mountains have long been held as religious sites throughout many cultures and many religions throughout the world. The belief is that the higher you can get, the closer you can get to the skies, the closer you can get to God or the gods or the heavens. So you can find lots of ancient religious sites on high mountains and hills. Temples and pyramids were built tall so that priests and parishioners could get as close to the skies as possible to offer their sacrifices and their supplications. Even the Jewish temple was built on the highest point in Jerusalem, the Temple Mount, it is called. And throughout the Old Testament, when God is scolding his people for their idolatry, he often tells them and chastises them for worshiping gods on the quote-unquote high places. They're trying to get to high locations because they think it gets them closer to God. Even today, we have this residue in our understanding of spiritual reality where we consider ourselves down here and God and heaven are up there. And if we were up there, maybe we would be closer to him. So, you remember the story from Genesis 11? It's the story of the Tower of Babel. This is when humanity gathered on the plains of Babylonia, and they decided they wanted to build a tower that could reach into the heavens, and they wanted to make a great name for themselves. It wasn't about God, it was about them, but they wanted to get up into the sky as far as they could go so that in their own power and their own ingenuity, they could reach the heavens and plunder the blessings of God on their own. They were reaching, they were grasping for blessing in their own power. So they built this tower. They began to, at least, this, it would have been called a ziggurat, which is a common ancient structure, a common ancient religious structure, a pyramid-like structure with stairs that enabled worshipers to ascend to the pinnacle. And once they got to the top, they would plunder the heavens. But of course, God thwarted their plans and scattered the people. And as we jump into Genesis 28, now I want you to keep Genesis 11 in mind. There's some really interesting hyperlinks that will help us understand what's going on in Genesis 28. But this idea of ascending to the heights in order to worship God, man-made power, man-made ability, us grasping and reaching for heaven on our own, God shows us how futile and unnecessary that is. If you're new with us, we've been on a long journey through Genesis. This is our third series in the book of Genesis where we've gone through the whole book. This series, we're going from chapter 25 to 35, and we're looking at the story of Jacob. We've been calling him Jake the Snake because he's a wrestler. In so many of the stories about Jake, he's identified as someone with the same features as the deceiving snake in the Garden of Eden. He carries this deceiving mentality about him, yet God still chooses him and uses him to carry his blessing. He's received the blessing of God through his family lineage, through his father Isaac, and before him Abraham, and now he is the carrier of God's blessing in his generation. However, he has found himself in a very unblessed situation. In the story we read last time, he deceived his brother he deceived his father into giving him the family blessing, which was supposed to go to his brother. And now he's been exiled from his family. He's wandering the wilderness alone and penniless. His brother wants to murder him. He's never going to see his mom again. He has nothing to his name. He's in the middle of nowhere. He's in a completely unblessed situation, even though he's supposed to be the carrier of God's blessing in the world. And so we pick up the story in Genesis 28, starting in verse 10. Jacob left Beersheba and traveled toward Haran. At sundown, he arrived at a good place to set up camp and stopped there for the night. I'm not sure why the New Living Translation, which I'm using today, talks about this being a good place to set up camp, because the intent here is actually to tell the reader that Jacob is in the middle of nowhere. He's in a wilderness. He's in a place of uncreation, a place almost like before God showed up to form it and order it. He is in the middle of nowhere, a desert place. No one's close by. There's no identifying landmarks or special spots. There's nothing that makes it particularly beautiful. It's not a place that you would settle down in. Maybe a modern equivalent in Canada is if you were driving across the prairies and you needed a place to stop and you found a place that had a gas station and a Motel 6, you would say, good enough for the night. If we stay here two nights, we'll probably get murdered, but we'll stay here one night and we'll move on. There's nothing special about this place. So it says, Jacob found a stone to rest his head against and lay down to sleep. I think this is supposed to remind us how desperate and destitute Jacob is. He doesn't even have a backpack or a bedroll to lay his head on. He finds a stone to lay his head on. So I wanted to try this. We just happen to have a rock right here. And he has nothing. And so he thinks better than nothing is to lay down on a stone to rest, to go to sleep. Now, I don't know about you, but it would be my first choice. If I'm in this situation... Incoming dad joke alert. I've hit rock bottom. Thank you, dads. Now, wow, thank you. But Jacob, as he goes to sleep, he's about to have a dream. A powerful, amazing, life-shaking, benchmark moment in Scriptures kind of dream. And I don't know if you knew this, but in the Bible, the most common way, bar none, that God speaks to people is through dreams. It's the most common way God speaks in the entire Bible. In Genesis 15, we already saw this story. He spoke to Abraham in a dream about a burning torch and a smoking pot. Later in the book, he'll speak to Pharaoh through dreams that Joseph interprets. Later in the scriptures, Nebuchadnezzar has dreams that Daniel interprets. Solomon has a dream where God comes to him and says, "Ask me for anything," and Solomon asks for wisdom. In the New Testament, Joseph is visited by an angel in his dream who tells him to accept Jesus as his son. The wise men are warned in a dream not to go back to Herod after they met Jesus. Peter is told in a dream that the Gentiles are going to be included in the new covenant. Over and over and over again, God speaks to people through dreams. For some reason, it seems to be his favorite method of communication. And so I just wanted to pause for a moment before we get into this to invite you to invite God to speak to you in your dreams. Like, I don't think he's stopped doing that. In every 24-hour cycle on this planet, I am unconscious for 6 to 8 hours. It's wonderful. It's a glorious 6 to 8 hours of my day. I need it. My body needs it. But in that time of unconsciousness, I'm completely unproductive. I'm not doing anything. I'm not producing anything. I'm not building the church. I'm not writing sermons. I'm not training leaders. I'm not visiting the sick. I'm not praying for you. I'm just unconscious. I'm not doing anything at home. I'm not serving my kids. I'm not helping my wife. I'm not doing the dishes. I'm not mowing the lawn. I'm not doing anything. But guess who's still awake and at work? God. And so there's been many times as I remember to do this where when I put my head on the pillow, I just pray a simple prayer like, "God, while I'm sleeping, can you work in my life?" Because he can still shape me and produce something in me, and he can shape my heart and build my character and give me strength and empower me and prepare me for the next day or whatever I have coming up. God can still work, and God can speak to me in dreams as well. In those 6 to 8 hours, he can give me dreams and visions and put an image in my mind that inspires me and prepares me or helps me understand something that's going to come up. And so all I'm just saying and suggesting is just ask God to do it and be ready when it happens. Like when you wake up, if you've had a dream, just ask God, "Was that from you? And is there anything you're trying to tell me about that?" Just ask him. Because maybe your dream is because you ate some like bad leftover pizza. But maybe your dream is because God is speaking to you. And you just need to ask him, "God, what is that dream something I'm supposed to be aware of, to think about, to meditate on?" And I don't think we need, like, I've seen Christian ministries that like teach people how to interpret dreams. I think that's silly. I think that's actually pagan. We have examples in Babylonian practice where they had dream manuals. Manuals don't interpret dreams. God interprets dreams. That's what Daniel says to King, that's what Joseph says to Pharaoh. "I can't interpret your dream, Pharaoh, but God can." So if you have a dream, just ask God, "Does this mean anything?" Because I think God still wants to speak to his people in dreams. And so here's what happens. He's sleeping on the rock. As he slept, verse 12, he dreamed of a stairway that reached from the earth up to heaven. And he saw the angels of God going up and down the stairway. At the top of the stairway stood the Lord, and he said, "I am the Lord, the God of your grandfather Abraham and the God of your father Isaac. The ground you were lying on belongs to you. I am giving it to you and your descendants. Your descendants will be as numerous as the dust of the earth. They will spread out in all directions, to the west and the east, to the north and the south, and all the families of the earth will be blessed through you and your descendants. What's more, I am with you, and I will protect you wherever you go. One day I will bring you back to this land. I will not leave you until I have finished giving you everything I have promised you." Now, this dream doesn't need a ton of interpretation. There's a couple symbols in there that we need to know. But God speaks directly to Jacob. It's not like John's vision and Revelation where everything's symbolic and wild and crazy and hard to understand. But he just speaks it straight forward to him. We'll get into it more in a second, but let's just keep reading in verse 16. "Then Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, 'Surely the Lord is in this place, and I wasn't even aware of it.' But he was also afraid and said, 'What an awesome place this is. It is none other than the house of God, the very gateway to heaven.'" So we're going to read a little bit further in a minute, but I'm going to pause here to highlight the one big idea that I want to point out today. The one big idea in this passage, and it's this: God is always closer than you think. God is always closer than you think. Here's Jacob in the middle of nowhere. He's alone, he's broke, he's tired from travel, he's sleeping on a rock in the most unsuspecting place, at the most unsuspected time, at the most unsuspected way, God shows up. He's in the presence of God. There's no worship team to warm up the atmosphere. There's no worship leader with the trendiest clothes. There's no smoke or lights or great environment. He's just in a desert wilderness, asleep on a rock, and God shows up. The presence and power of the Lord is there. He says in response, "Surely the Lord is in this place, and I wasn't even aware of it." And that's the point of the setting of this story. It's not a place where you would expect God to be. And in the ancient world, it was not unlike our own, where we assume that for God to be present, there need to be certain ingredients that precede it. We need the right atmosphere, the right vibe, the right prayers prayed, the right rituals performed. But here's a guy in the middle of nowhere, sleeping on a rock, and he becomes aware that God has been close to him the whole time. And he didn't come to the conclusion that God arrived there and he hadn't been there before. It's like he wasn't there before he went to sleep, but then when he went to sleep, God arrived. No, he realized that God had been there the whole time. The difference was he wasn't aware of it until that moment. We live in an experiential world. Our assumptions are that if I can't feel it, I can't touch it, I can't see it, it must not be there. And it's our unconscious assumption all the time, just like Jacob, that God must not be around because I can't feel him. He must not be speaking because I can't hear him. He must not be real because I can't see him. And I think this is one of the reasons why Paul encouraged the Corinthians, fast forward in history, he said, "We live by faith and not by sight." And here's what Paul's not saying. Paul's not saying, hey, ignore the evidence. Ignore the fact that you can't feel him. Ignore the lack of evidence for his reality. What he's saying is, you know that God is near. You know that God is real. You know that Jesus died on the cross. But your senses are going to try to deceive you and get you to look at and focus on other things that make you forget what's actually real. So remember what is true and live by faith in that instead of constantly being deceived by the distractions around you. Let me illustrate this. I took my youngest son, Owen, to a virtual reality gaming studio a couple weeks ago. And I've done it a couple times now. It's pretty fun, really weird. It can confuse you. It messes with your perception of reality. So at this particular place, they put us in about an 8x8 cubicle, and then the helmet kind of comes down from the ceiling and goes over your head and flaps over your ears with sound. And so you're immersed in this complete reality, sight, sounds, everything. And so you can walk around a little bit in most of the games, but what happens is if you walk too close to the wall in the real world, inside your vision, there's this red grid that shows up that's kind of a warning, like you're going to hit the real wall. Because you can forget. You can think you're in a field, but there's actually a wall in reality. And so the first game Owen and I played was a baseball game where I started out as the pitcher, and I threw a virtual ball toward Owen, and he virtually hit the ball. And the next thing I hear is wham as Owen ran into the wall in his cubicle because he thought he was supposed to run to first base. He got deceived by his senses, forgetting what was actually real. Or in another game we played, and how can I explain this weird game? We were teddy bears and we had Nerf guns. And we were defending a pile of candy from other toys that wanted to steal our candy. It was really fun, actually. There were army men and tanks and even paper airplanes trying to steal our candy, and we had to shoot them. And so I was positioned on this stool, which if I was 6 feet tall like I am, it felt like it was like 20 feet off the ground because I was a little teddy bear. And I remember thinking, I'm going to test my perception of reality because I know that I am on solid floor that's 8x8. And I know that if I step over the edge of this stool, I will not fall. I will actually touch the floor in the VR studio. But I tell you, it was way harder than it should have been to take that one extra step over the edge of that stool. My mind, my lizard brain was just telling me, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it, you're going to fall. Because all of my senses were convinced that I was going to fall. But I knew that I knew that I knew that I was going to be safe. That's the difference between faith and sight. I knew what was real, but my sight was trying to deceive me. We live by faith, not by sight. So we need to start with, what do we know about God? God is always present. He is always close. He's omnipresent, which means he's always everywhere. But what does it often feel like? What do our senses often tell us? Our senses try to convince us he's not around. He's not close. He doesn't hear me. I can't hear him. He may not even be real. When's the last time I experienced the presence of God? But that feeling, friends, is the virtual world, not the real world. The real world is that God is always closer than you think. And the challenge of faith is to remember that even when everything else is screaming that God is not near. He is always closer than you think. Let's look at this scene again. Verse 12, as he slept, he dreamed of a stairway that reached from the earth up to heaven, and he saw the angels of God going up and down the stairway. Okay, this is why I wanted you to remember the Tower of Babel, because there's huge hyperlinks here. The stairway that he dreams about reached from earth up into heaven. It literally says its head reached into heaven, which is the exact same language from Babel. The people wanted to build a tower of which its head would reach into the heavens. So there's this deliberate connection here. And again, what Jacob is dreaming about is not like a stepladder that you're going to use to hang your Christmas lights. It's not a stairway like we have in our lobby ascending up into the balcony. What he's seeing is actually a ziggurat or maybe a stairway up against a mountain that goes up toward the heavens so that worshipers can go and experience the presence of God. And so he's seeing this very similar scene to what the people of Babel were trying to create. And what God is showing is the futility of the Babel project, the needlessness of it. Something that humanity wanted to create already existed. It was already there. They wanted to do it in their own way, but in God's way, he had already made a bridge between heaven and earth so that people could experience the presence of God. Verse 13, at the top of the stairway stood the Lord. Okay, I'm not an expert in the Hebrew language. I only pretend to be sometimes. But there's lots of good study tools that I use. And in this case, I consulted my rabbi. I have a rabbi. His name is Mark Hawks. He teaches Old Testament, particularly Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, at Summit Pacific College. He taught me when I was there, and now I preach, and he listens to me preach about the stuff he taught me. It's kind of weird. But I've been calling him Rabbi lately. I'm not sure if he likes it, but I like it, so feel free to join me in calling him Rabbi. But he and other sources confirmed my suspicions that in this particular case, when it talks about the stairway, where God stood above the stairway, it's actually very ambiguous as to where God was. Some translations like this one will say, at the top of the stairway stood the Lord. Others will just say, God stood above the stairway or above Jacob. And it can also be translated, God stood beside Jacob. So it confused me, what's true? Is God at the top of the stairway? Is he above the stairway? Is he above Jacob? Or is he beside Jacob? The answer is yes. That's the intentional effect here. The author is trying to let us know that yes, God is at the top. Yes, God is above. Yes, God is beside. Yes, God is with. He is the ever-present God with Jacob. He is the ever-present God, our Father in heaven. He is the ever-present God above us, beside us, with us, within us, all the time. He is always closer than we think. And that's the point of the story, because God comes to him and promises him, I am going to be with you. It's not just about this place. Everywhere you sleep is going to be like this. The next night, Jacob was going to experience the presence of God. The next night, Jacob was going to experience the presence of God. Maybe not in so powerful a dream. Maybe he wouldn't see or feel God like he did that night, but it would still be true that God would be with him. As you compare the revelation of God in our scriptures to beliefs about God or gods in the world religions, this is one of the biggest differentiating features of our faith. There is no sevenfold path to get to God. There are no five rituals that help us approach Him. There's no ladder, no stairway, no mountain to climb. God is always near. And here I think God is actually mocking the Babel Project. You guys thought you needed to build the world's tallest tower to get to me when I was here the whole time. Verse 15, as I said, I am with you. I will protect you wherever you go. Now, fast forward to Jesus, John chapter 1. And Jesus is thinking about this moment in time. And he's starting to gather some followers. And his followers are getting excited about what's happening. And they're telling friends about Jesus. And so this guy, Nathanael, was invited to come and meet Jesus. In John chapter 1, it says this, verse 47, as they approached, Jesus said to Nathanael, now here is a genuine son of Israel, a man of complete integrity. How do you know about me? Nathanael asked. Which is funny, because Jesus just gave him a compliment. And he's like, hey, he knows I'm a man of complete integrity, right? It's a little bit of pride there. Anyways, so how do you know about me? Jesus replied, I could see you under the fig tree before Philip found you. Then Nathanael exclaimed, Rabbi, you are the Son of God, the King of Israel. So what did Jesus just reveal about himself? Nathanael was only meeting Jesus in person for the first time in this moment, but Jesus says, I saw you when you were under the tree back then. So when I was over here, I saw you when you were over there. What's Jesus revealing about himself? He is the ever-present God. He is the omnipresent God of the universe, the God of Jacob and Abraham and Isaac, who was revealed in the Old Testament. Nathanael didn't know. Remember, note this. Nathanael didn't know that Jesus was with him under the tree. But he was. There have been so many times in your life you didn't realize Jesus was with you. But he was. He was. In reality, he was. Your virtual reality told you he wasn't, but he absolutely was. But then Jesus kind of snickers because Nathanael immediately believes in him and declares his faith in him. But Jesus, he's kind of like, do you like that trick? Verse 50, he asked him, do you believe this just because I told you I had seen you under the fig tree? You will see greater things than these. Listen to what he says. Then he said, I tell you the truth. You will all see heaven open and the angels of God going up and down on the Son of Man, the one who is the stairway between heaven and earth. So Jesus has already identified himself as the ever-present God at the top, above, beside, with Jacob. And now he's added himself into another image of this story. He's actually the stairway itself, connecting heaven and earth. You see, this great division between heaven and earth is not possible through human achievement. And there actually remain barriers to it being accomplished because of human sin. But Jesus is the one who descends from heaven to earth, and by his blood, by his work on the cross, he makes a way, he connects the two realities, he gets us back together with God, he becomes the presence of God with humankind. He is the way, the truth, and the life. It was later when Thomas said, I don't know how I'm going to get to heaven, Jesus. Jesus says, I am the way. And so us getting to God is not about following religious practices and rules and regulations and sevenfold this or five steps to this or us accomplishing something or us being good enough to get there. It's just a matter of clinging to the way of Jesus, clinging to the one who has made a way, grasping onto him, because if we are connected to Jesus, we are already on the way. Let's finish reading and wrap this up. Verse 18, the next morning, Jacob got up very early. He took the stone he had rested his head against, and he set it upright as a memorial pillar. Then he poured olive oil over it. He named the place Bethel, which means house of God, although it was previously called Luz. Then Jacob made this vow, if God will indeed be with me and protect me on this journey, and if he will provide me with food and clothing, and if I return safely to my father's home, then the Lord will certainly be my God. And this memorial pillar I have set up will become a place for worshiping God, and I will present to God a tenth of everything he gives me. Okay, two things that Jacob does here. One, he sets up a memorial. In this incredible moment where he realized that all along, God was closer than he thought, he wants a way to remember it. And I think a lot of us have had times in our lives, whether recently or long in the past, where we have had a great encounter with God, we have heard a word from God, we have experienced a blessing from God, but what happens is our virtual reality starts to erode the memory. And it starts to dampen our faith that was spurred on and ignited from that moment in the past, because we're starting to forget. It's one of the reasons why Jesus gives us the practice of communion. He says, do this in remembrance of me, to remember regularly what I did for you. So Jacob, this isn't a religious thing. This is Jacob personally saying, I want a way to remember this moment. And so he sets up a memorial. But he doesn't have anything. He's broke. He's penniless. He doesn't have anything. So what does he do? He finds his one possession that he has found in the desert. And he says, this, I can't even stand this thing up. See, that's all he had. He's like, this rock that I slept on, this is what's going to help me remember God. I'm going to remember that this rock that I slept on helped me realize that God is closer than he thinks. He poured oil over it. He named the place Bethel, which means house of God. He set up this physical structure as a means to remember God, which is interesting again because the Babylonians, they piled brick upon brick upon brick to build this beautiful, massive human structure in order to make a name for themselves and plunder the treasures of heaven, whereas Jacob was trying to make a name for God, realizing that he doesn't need to force God to bless him. God is already near. God is already blessing him, and he just needs to remember it by this silly, terrible, it's just a rock. It's all it is. But it's a memory for him. It's something to mark the moment, so that he doesn't forget the goodness of God in his life. So what's it for you? Like, we don't need to build towers to God. We don't need to build monuments to God. But what can you do to remember what God has done in your life? Can you write it down? Can you put up a scripture on the wall? How will you remember that God has blessed you and that God is near? Secondly, he made a commitment. Band, you can come back up. Let me read this again. He says, if God will indeed be with me and protect me on this journey, and if he will provide for me with food and clothing, and if I return safely to my father's house, then the Lord will certainly be my God. And this memorial pillar I have set up will become a place for worshiping God, and I will present to God a tenth of everything he gives me. Now, his commitment here, it's mixed, because it's a lot of if, right? I mean, God's already made all these promises, but Jacob's like, I want you to fulfill your promises in the way I want you to fulfill your promises. So he's still a work in progress here. But he does say, I will worship you. I am committed to you being my God. And then he says, I'm going to give a tithe of everything you give me. Jacob at this point had nothing, and he knew that everything he was going to receive from here on out was going to be a direct blessing from God. So he said, I will worship you by giving a tenth back to you as an act of trust and worship in you. You know, our promises often sound like Jacob's. If you'll do this for me, if you'll give me a good job, if you'll find me a good-looking spouse, if you'll heal my sickness, if you'll fill my bank account, if you'll fulfill my dreams. But I think sometimes when we give God a job description, we actually limit the opportunity we have to experience his blessing. Because God was going to bless Jacob way beyond what Jacob was asking for here. He just like was saying, if he gives me food and clothing, God's like, I'm going to give you so much more than that. Don't limit by saying if. Just stick with the second part of what Jacob said. He said, the Lord will certainly be my God. That's a good commitment. An open-ended commitment. God, you do the God part. I'm going to do the worshiping part. I'm going to do the trusting part. Or as Joshua later said, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Or as Thomas said when he met the resurrected Jesus, he said, my Lord and my God. And I wonder today, in light of Jacob's response, if I can invite you to respond in a more intentional way than I normally do. if God is speaking to you in this moment, if your desire is that the closeness of God would become a reality, that your faith would be stronger than your sight, I want to invite you to step out of your seats and just as a memorial, as a moment, almost like setting up a rock just to say, this is a moment that I'm giving to the Lord. This is a moment I want to remember. This is a moment that I want to dedicate to Him. Can we just fill this altar? Can we just come and spread out, whether it's in the aisles, or it'd be great to fill up this front space? You know, we had some great altar ministry times at our district conference this week, and maybe I just want that to continue and to spill over into our church. But can we just say, can we just come and in your own words declare something along the lines of, the Lord will be my God. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. My Lord and my God. Would you come stand with me as we pray, and I'm going to invite you as the band sings. Jesus, 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 thank you. Thank you that you have bridged the divide between heaven and earth. Thank you that you are closer than we think. Thank you in moments where we're under the fig tree, completely unaware of your presence, whatever it is we're going through, whatever trials we're facing, whatever barriers are in our way, whatever sin we're struggling with, whatever virtual reality is blinding our faith. Jesus, you're always with us. I pray, Jesus, that you would show us by your grace. You would reveal your presence to us. You would fill us with faith to know that you are always closer than we think. And today, we just want to have a memorial moment where we just set a benchmark. We put a stone in the ground to say, I want to remember this moment when Jesus became fully real and fully alive. Maybe today you just need to make a commitment to Jesus for the first time. Say, Jesus, you are going to be my God. I'm going to worship you and follow you and trust you. No ifs, no ifs, but just I'm going to trust you today. Would you come? Would you come? In Jesus' name, amen. Let's worship together with this song that Jesus is our firm foundation. He's the rock on which we stand. It's Him, it's Him, it's Him alone that gives us a firm foundation upon which we can build our whole life. Continue to come. Let's sing.
Thank you for listening to the APA podcast. We hope it helps you better follow Jesus in your home, city, and around the world.